anniversary of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. And heavy rains wreak havoc in northeastern U.S., leaving parts of New York City underwater, with motors stranded in flooded streets. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News. China slams the U.S. as a true empire of lies, following a State Department report that accused Beijing of information manipulation. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said the report has disregarded facts. It added agencies of the U.S. State Department that produced the report were the source of false information and a command post of cognitive warfare. On Thursday, the State Department accused Beijing of manipulating global media through censorship, data harvesting, and covert purchases of foreign news outlets. It claims China has hit major setbacks when targeting democratic countries due to local media and civil society pushback. The report comes as Beijing is seeking to combat Western media, which are trying to offer negative images of China. Now, the UN Investigation Committee probing Israeli occupation of Palestinian land has called on all world countries to take immediate measures to bring Israel's violations to an end. A call was made by the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry. It said that the Israeli occupation is illegal under international law, adding illegal actions require legal consequences for Israel to put an end to those acts. The committee said Israel has violated and is still violating the right of Palestinian people to self-determination through its long-term occupation, settlement, and annexation of Palestinian territories for decades. The report comes as Israel has been defiant of international calls to bring its atrocities in occupied territories to an end. Palestinian resistance factions have organized a rally in the blockaded Gaza Strip, marking the 23rd anniversary of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Also known as the Second Intifada, it was sparked by the desecration of the Islamic Holy Shrine by then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Ashraf Shannon has your story.
Palestinians in Gaza rallied on Saturday to mark the 23rd anniversary of the Second Palestinian Popular Uprising, which is also known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada. The Al-Aqsa Intifada was sparked by the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds in September 2000 by then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his bodyguards. Palestinians have been holding protests in the eastern part of the Gaza Strip for the last 3 weeks, aiming to draw international attention to the continued Israeli human rights violations in Al-Quds. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
23 years have passed since the beginning of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, and we continue to fight for our holy places. The Israeli enemy must not provoke the Palestinian people. The equation has not changed, and Palestine remains an Islamic land. Today we assert that we will fight for our rights, and we will use all the forms of resistance, including armed resistance, to liberate Al-Quds and all of our land.
Protesters held placards denouncing the Israeli regime's desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. They also denounced the international and Arab silence on the unabated Israeli crimes in Al-Quds.
Intifada means that there is determination for Palestinians to face the Israeli aggression and colonialization and settlement and achieve Palestinian rights for self-determination and right of return.
In recent weeks, the Israeli forces have increased their presence near the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, taking advantage of Jewish holidays.
The Intifada continues because of the ongoing Israeli aggression against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on the international community to exert real pressure on the occupying Israeli regime to stop its grave violations against the Palestinian people.
Observers say the Israeli regime and its regional and international backers are responsible for the escalation of violence in Al-Quds.
23 years on, Palestinians say they are determined to free Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, no matter what sacrifices are required. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Now, new footage has been released showing a U.S. military convoy allegedly transporting Syrian oil to Iraq. A video dates back to September 26. It was released by Cradle Online News Magazine. Says dozens of tankers pass weekly in convoys transporting smuggled Syrian oil accompanied by U.S. warplanes and helicopters. According to the Cradle, Syrian oil is then transported to the Hadid military site in Erbil. There, oil is emptied into other tanks that carry it to U.S. base at Ain al-Assad in Anbar province. U.S. military has stationed its forces and equipment in northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus maintains the deployment is only meant to plunder Syria's natural resources. Heavy rains overnight have triggered a flash flooding in New York City, turning streets into fast-moving rivers and grinding subway travel to a halt. Images from around New York show cars half submerged and traffic snarled, with some major roads completely blocked. The subway system's also been impacted, with several lines closed throughout Brooklyn. New York Airport also closed one of its terminals. City's mayor has declared a state of emergency throughout New York City and urged people not to venture out. People complain officials have been slow to react to the situation. New Yorkers say they are dissatisfied with transit delays.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I've been, stay safe and hope everyone else is safe out there. It's pretty tough to get around, but it passes quick.
I'm lost. I feel terrible. I don't even know where I'm going because I'm accustomed to catching a particular train. Now I come, the train is delayed. I don't know when. It's disgusting.
Now I have myself and another person. We're trying to keep pumping out. You see, he's throwing out the bucket of water, you know, outside. You know, we are really, really suffering. And, you know, we live like any other resident of New York City. And the suffering is severe here.
No deaths or critical injuries have been reported yet. Now, New York City has had nearly 14 inches of rain so far this month, making it the wettest September since 1882, according to official figures. Observers have warned the flooding chaos is a result of climate crisis. Colin Campbell says flooding has prompted criticism of New York City officials, with some claiming they're too slow to communicate the storm about the storm.
There seems to be a lack of alert or a lack of broadcasting as to how people should handle the floodwaters. Now, we're looking at a situation where about 8 to 10 centimeters of water just fell out of the sky in just a few hours. And so this caused a lot of buildup in many places around New York and New Jersey, of course, just outside of New York there, where you had cars that were stranded. And there were a lot of people who did not seem to know what to do next. Where to go, where to find resources, where to stay away from the flooding. And so some people were trapped. And I think that there was a lack of messaging here from what some people are saying who lived in the area. Now, this storm is not as deadly as when Hurricane Ida passed over this area not too long ago, and there were dozens of deaths. There won't be that many casualties in this type of flooding type of situation. However, there is expected to be extensive damage to buildings because of all the water that fell. Now, there are only about a few hours left for the rain to abate. Rain has slowed down since yesterday afternoon. It was really a deluge that happened Friday afternoon, which really shut down most of New York, especially during rush hour. People had to hurry up and get home and find alternative ways of getting back to their homes because a lot of the public transportation was shut down.
Now, Slovaks are voting in tight parliamentary elections, seen as a key to whether the country will keep supporting neighboring Ukraine. Now, voting is mainly between a former leftist prime minister, Robert Fico, who wants to end military aid for neighboring Ukraine, and pro-Western liberals. Final opinion polls show Fico's party neck and neck with progressive Slovakia. The winner will form a government to replace caretaker administration running the country since May. Now, voting is due to end at 2000 GMT. Exit polls are expected shortly afterwards, and final results due Sunday morning. In France, the government continues to enforce controversial budget cuts via executive decree, and even as West economic woes continue to rage, people have taken to the streets around the country demanding action on a long-running housing crisis, which has reached new proportions amid record inflation. Rami Mazahiri reports out of Paris.
In the past few presidential elections, the number one voter demand has been to address housing issues, which are suffered by one out of every four people in France. Many consider the European refugee crisis to be in its eighth year, adding to the national housing policy failure. The failure of Western sanctions on Russia has helped rent to explode over the last year by over 7%, or an entire monthly payment. Major demonstrations were held across the country to demand the government finally take action for adequate and stable shelter.
The government isn't proposing any solutions for these people with housing problems or who are completely homeless. These are people who work, who pay their taxes, and yet still find themselves on the streets. It's a big, big problem, but we don't expect anything from this government, given how they responded to the fair requests of the Yellow Vests.
Demonstrators demanded rent freezes and reductions, the taxing of real estate corporations and multiple homeowners, and the requisitioning of a record 3.2 million empty lodgings. However, historically, there have been few signs that the administration of Emmanuel Macron is interested in dialogue. The 2024 budget has just been released, but don't expect to see it debated in Parliament. President Macron has just used his usual executive decree to force through yet another austerity budget with billions in cuts to government services despite the record economic hardship.
Macron uses the 49.3 executive decree so the people remain silent. People are scared, and that's now our biggest problem. This fear has led to inaction and political apathy, and that's even though I hear everyone around me relating how bad things are going for them and for society. I don't understand their inaction, but I do understand their fear of getting involved, given the massive repression and lack of democracy here.
Many say that housing is actually an issue which any committed government can fix in just a few years. By making laws which favor tenants and not rich landlords, by putting more taxes into building public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
A new study has shown Britain's cost of living crisis is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. Millions of Britons have been hit hard by levels of inflation unseen in decades, and it's been blamed on a number of reasons, including the Ukraine war, the COVID pandemic, Brexit, and the government's mishandling of economic policies.
A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis that mainly results from the government's economic policy is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. The results of the research were published by the BMJ Public Health Journal. The study showed that the cost of living crisis and sustained period of high prices will reduce life expectancy among the people across the country by 6.5% this year. The predicted increase in premature deaths from a baseline of 463 per 100,000 people to 493 per 100,000 equates to thousands of extra deaths a year in the UK. The study says that the most deprived households will experience four times the number of extra deaths than the wealthiest households, with the poorest having to spend a large proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Evidence shows low income is associated with poorer health, and that falls in income adversely affects health. According to last month's figures, the UK's inflation stood at 6.7%.
For me, this whole conversation is about whether I heat the house or whether I breathe. And it's so hard to describe what that feels like in real terms because it's an immediate threat to your life.
Although it was down from a high of 11.1%, Britain's inflation still remains the highest among the member states of the Group of Seven. Meanwhile, there are gloomy predictions about UK's economic prospects. A report by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says that the UK economy will shrink this year and in 2024. It says a drop in GDP this year of 0.3% would be followed by a fall of 0.2% next year.
Now, if we look at the data that we've seen recently, obviously there can be some revisions in the GDP data. We saw quite a contraction in July. Now, we are expecting perhaps there are some quirks in the data that we haven't seen as much industrial action recently, and there could be some technical issues and a rebound. But I think the outlook for the rest of this year is quite weak. And we see that, as you've mentioned, in the PMI surveys, both manufacturing and services moving into contraction.
Now, the British economy is expected to shrink this year and the next. That's according to a study by Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics. So the persistent inflation and shortage of workers, among other things, will result in a 0.3% drop in the UK's gross domestic product this year.
There are fears that the UK is suffering from structural economic conditions. Factors related to the underlying weakness of the UK economy and the fallout from Brexit will leave the UK behind, while most other developed economies expand. UK was also suffering from an unequal recovery that benefited better-off households, while the bottom half of the income scale continued to be affected by falling real incomes. Persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in the drop in the country's gross domestic product. Cuts to government spending next year will also drag on economic growth. The central bank held rates at 5.25% at its meeting, and betting on financial markets showed investors expect there will be no change at the next meeting in November. The next move could be upwards should inflation prove to be more stubborn than the central bank's forecasts predict, despite a weakening of economic growth.
I think really what we're seeing is they are worried about the recession. They are worried about weaker growth, and they think that perhaps going into the rest of this year, inflation is likely to continue to decelerate. So what we're seeing is the lagged impact of fairly aggressive monetary tightening really starting to bite. And they're probably thinking, right, that here is a time to pause, but we don't want to get too complacent. There are still a lot of inflationary pressures ahead.
The economic crisis and persistent inflation has caused trouble for the ruling Tories in the UK. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's popularity has fallen to its lowest levels ever. Some 68% of Britons currently have an unfavorable view of the Prime Minister, the highest figure since becoming Prime Minister, while only 23% have a favorable view.
The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. Yep. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. The sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Unity and new Islamic civilization. A few decades after the emergence of Islam, the Islamic civilization started thriving in the Arabian Peninsula and beyond. The Islamic civilization was the torchbearer of science and culture for several centuries. This civilization blossomed in a very uncivilized and uncultured region of the world, while the adjacent civilizations too were in decline. To put it more clearly, the ancient Iran, Rome and Greece were going through very bleak and decadent juncture. Muslims, inspired by the teachings of the Prophet and following his behaviour and practice, established the foundations of a civilization and culture which became the luminous beacon for all seekers of knowledge and lofty human merits. It set the ground for the growth of engineers, chemists, physicists, philosophers, physicians, astronomers, geologists, mathematicians, geographers, lawyers, and many other scientists who played significant roles in flourishing of human culture in every field. The expansion of scientific disciplines and morality, importance of thinking, dominance of the spirit of solidarity and collectivity over egotism, profiteering and totalitarianism, blend of labour and faith were among the outstanding features of the Islamic civilization for several centuries. It can be said that a very prominent feature of the Islamic civilization is the fact that it never attaches itself to a particular race, a particular ethnicity or language. Therefore, various ethnicities such as Arabs, Turks, Indians, Chinese, Africans, Mongols and Persians had all a share and enjoyed the thriving of the Islamic civilization. However, for sure, ethics and spirituality had a very determining status in the Islamic civilization. As in the contemporary era, the Islamic Revolution in Iran took place with the same features, and it has been considered as the most important revolution of not just the 20th century, but the second millennium. Naturally, a revolution that is based on the Islamic and Quranic values will try to revive the past glorious civilization in the modern era. The zenith of the ideal of the Islamic Revolution is to build the new Islamic civilization on the basis of Imam Mahdi's government. In view of this, unity among all Muslims is a very important factor. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "Unity of the Islamic world has levels. The lowest level is that the Islamic communities, Islamic countries and Islamic governments and Islamic ethnicities, Islamic sects do not embark on conflict and do not clash with one another, do not deal a blow to one another. This is the first step. Of course, higher than this is that the Islamic world, besides avoiding dealing blows to each other, become hand in hand against a common enemy, have true and sufficient unity and defend one another. This is also an upper step. Higher than this is that the Islamic countries, Islamic nations make synergy. Islamic countries are not at the same level in terms of sciences, wealth, security and political power. They can help one another and make synergy. Those who are higher in any section take the hand of those who are lower. This is another phase of unity. The higher phase is that the whole Islamic world gets united for reaching the new Islamic civilization. This is what the Islamic Republic of Iran has considered as its ultimate goal, reaching the Islamic civilization. Yet a civilization proportionate with the age, the new Islamic civilization. These are the levels of unity." The Islamic civilization can be likened to a construction that, if it is to be built properly and beautifully, it requires coordination and thinking together of engineers and experts. Thus, the formation of the new Islamic civilization requires unity and convergence of Muslim thinkers and scientists. It is in exigent need of struggles of all Muslims, hope in the divine assistance, God-weariness, insight, vigilance, refraining from backwardness and small-mindedness, spread of ethics, scrutiny of all human sciences and achievements, serious shunning of absorption and digestion by Western culture. The Islamic civilization is quite opposite to the Western civilization. Progress in the Western civilization is accumulation of wealth and advancement in science, technology, and military matters. But progress in Islam has much more dimensions and includes ethics, justice, public welfare, dignity, international credit, political sovereignty, and independence, all of which are tools for reaching servitude of Allah and attaining His proximity. Therefore, the Islamic civilization seeks both material and spiritual progress. The pioneers of the Islamic unity believe that coherence and comprehension around common ideological and intellectual axes will provide the ground for materialization of this aspiration of mankind. For instance, faith in Allah, the Holy Prophet, the Holy Quran, love of the Holy Prophet's household or the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, a single Qibla, the Hajj pilgrimage, hijab, and so on, are commonalities of all Muslims. Moreover, the existence of common enemies and challenges are fundamental factors which can help to unite all Muslims. Positive dialogue, closeness of thought, refraining from insulting each other's sanctities, not engaging in rumour-mongering, hypocrisy and hostility, seeking the truth, shunning obstinacy, moving from slogan towards practice, are other factors which can cement unity among Islamic communities. Participation in each other's religious ceremonies and gatherings like Friday prayers and the Hajj pilgrimage will also bolster unity. We all know that Muslims enjoy common and similar rituals for marriage, divorce, business, world outlook, etc. In the course of building up of the Islamic civilization, we should permanently monitor the plots of the enemies and stand against them with insight, steadfastness and courage. We must never allow the hypocrites to infiltrate the ranks of Muslims. Muslims should do their best to gain their lost position as the reference of sciences and technologies in the world. This will materialize for sure, God willing, inshallah.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You're listening to I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Thank you very much for inviting.
Thank you very much again for accepting my invitation to the program Viewpoints. Today we want to talk about the personality of Jesus Christ, or Isa ibn Maryam, Hazrat Masih. Also, these are the titles that are used for Prophet of Allah. and also Lady Mary or Hazrat Maryam, as pictured in the religion of Islam and the Quran, and the respect that Islam had for these two very dear personalities. Samir Salih Sassal, with you, brother, how the religion of Islam looked at the very personality of Hazrat Masih.
Thank you very much. You know, Jesus, an English name,
yes,
and Mary, both are very special characters, and they have a special status, actually, in the religion of Islam, because these two characters have been compared to many other, you know, characters around the world, and their names have been many times mentioned and brought in the Book of Islam, Quran. So when Islam is bringing these two names and is quoting on them and is talking about their lifestyles and is providing the whole humanity some information how these people were faithful to God, so it shows that the religion of Islam is not only against Jesus and Mary, but also is supporting them and is asking people to respect them highly.
Yes.
So this is a picture that Islam draws of these two great personalities. Jesus is the prophet to God.
Yes.
And God revealed even a book, Gospel, to Jesus.
Yes.
So it shows that Jesus is one of the descendants of Abraham.
Yes.
So it shows that the prophet of Islam and Jesus both have their, you know, backgrounds the same.
Yes.
So it shows that Islam has compared Jesus and Mary with many other personalities, and the great respect has been given to them.
That's right. But Sayyid Mohsen, the look that even some of the Christian communities has at their own prophets and their books is very much different from what the religion of Islam has. And this makes a question that who knows better is religion? You know, the followers of the same religion or the followers of the religion that comes, you know, so many years after that? What's your answer to that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when we talk about the Islam, Islam is not a separate religion from what Jesus Christ brought for the people of that time. We should bear in mind that the Judaism or Christianity, this word Christianity or Judaism,
yes,
this is a word which was made by people themselves, and not this name wasn't put by the prophets over the people. For example, Jesus did not said like, whoever will follow me or whoever I'm preaching, they are Christians.
Okay.
This deviation and the, yes, names were put by the people themselves.
Yes.
Whereas in the Quran, Allah says, Bani Israel.
Okay.
There's no Judaism. And obviously, when we see this, like the people who later put a specific name for themselves because they're attaching themselves to someone. So they got the name of Christianity and the Judaism. When we talk about the Islam, we have many verses in the Quran, and there are many proofs in the Quran, the verses that say, like, all the prophets who came, they all brought one thing, and that was Islam itself. Means submitting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Islam in its literal meaning, submitting. And Muslim also means, or the Muslim, when we say Muslim, it means the one who submits.
Yes.
So all the prophets, they asked their people to submit to one God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
And that was the main theme of every single prophet. So when we say, like, do we know more? Does Islam knows more, or the people who are following? We should also look at the history that the gospel which brother has referred to, when it was written. It was written later, like after like 400 years,
okay,
of Jesus. Like,
you mean this is not the same text that was revealed?
No, it wasn't the same text which was said by the Jesus. It,
okay,
was written 400 years after that.
Okay.
And the Old Testament that we have, it was written 1,000 years after the Moses.
Okay.
So we need to look at the historical aspect as well. Whereas the Quran, when we're talking about the Quran itself, it was written at the time of the prophet, and he dictated the verses which he used to reveal.
Okay.
So I don't think this is a right question, like if we want to say, or it is not right to say,
okay,
like the Muslims do not know about the Jesus because they are not the follower. We are the hard follower of Jesus and Moses,
yes,
and Abraham as well, because,
yes,
they are our prophets. And to become a Muslim must believe in 124,000 prophets,
okay,
from which there is a Jesus and there is Moses. And in the Quran, we can,
yes,
see many times Allah has said, Isa ibn Maryam. He refers to the Jesus, son of Mary, and also to the prophet Abraham and the Moses. And we know that the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they all are the Abrahamic religions. So when the main person who's like, we call ourselves Abrahamic, so we all refer back to Ibrahim alayhi salam.
And the monotheistic wonder religions all across the world. But say, Murtaza, you know, the question is now, we must have enough knowledge about the previous religions too, you know, as a Muslim. And this is when maybe some of the Muslims around the world does not have enough knowledge about their own religions and the details around. And I think this gives us a kind of authenticity about how the religions were revealed to the prophets of Allah during the history and how the religion of Islam could complete the previous versions of the religions, isn't so?
You know, historically talking, everyone needs actually to learn a lesson from history. And when it comes to speaking about religions and the background of religions and the religions that were actually before and after one another. So let's look at Jesus Christ and his mother Mary in the Book of Islam. And we know that the Book of Islam, Quran specifically, has put a great emphasis on Jesus' presence in society and Mary in society as well. So, you know, these two acted strongly like messengers, and they actually received messages from God, and then it was disseminated and distributed among people. So the same two roles have been, you know, followed and have been taken by Jesus Christ and his mother. So it shows a footstep to all of us that we need to follow in their footsteps, like we Muslims must follow in footsteps of our prophets and all our infallible imams.
That's
right. So it shows to all of us that what has been preached, it must be practiced.
That's right.
So unfortunately, we don't have this. In Christianity, unfortunately, we have a lot of rules that most of them have been overlooked by Christians.
Yes.
And in Judaism, we have the same thing, because I had my personal studies related to these factors.
Okay.
We have commonalities, we have similarities between religions, but unfortunately, those rules, the very effective rules, have been overlooked by the followers. And it shows that Islam as a religion has a better understanding, has a better description of the role of Jesus Christ and his mother. So it shows that people need to learn a very good lesson from the history and look at the picture how Islam actually created of Jesus Christ and his mother.
That's right. But Sayyid Mohsen, what was the main reason of revealing such ayahs to the Prophet of Islam in Arab Peninsula about the previous prophets, especially Prophet Masih, you know, Isa ibn Maryam, Jesus Christ, and Lady Mary? This is really a great question to be asked, you know, that what was the main reason? I mean, what is the use? For example, the ignorant Arabs, the Jahil Arab on that time, being familiar with the previous prophets, was there any intention behind that?
Well, first of all, let me just make clear that when we talk about the Arabs, the way you said Jahil or ignorant.
Sorry, no, at the time of Jahiliyyah, sorry.
Even when we use the word Jahiliyyah, that does not mean they were ignorant. You know, they had the best poets, and when they used to hear a poem from someone, they used to memorize it at the spot.
Okay.
So they were intelligent at that time. The Jahalat is something else. The Jahalat we refer because they were worshipping idols.
Okay.
They were not worshipping the God and the religions, the Abrahamic religions. That's why, you know, they were in the Jahalat, in the darkness. This Jahalat means darkness, not the ignorance.
Okay.
That's the first thing.
Okay.
The second thing is, when we look at the prophets, we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent 124,000 prophets. But we don't see their names in the Quran, not all of them.
Yes.
The answer is, if the Quran was the book of history, then you would find all the names with their date of birth, I don't know, date of demise, and the place where they were. Whereas the Quran is the book of guidance. It has revealed to give guidance and give lesson to the people, to take people towards the right path. Therefore, those prophets who are mentioned in the Quran, number one, they are Ulul Azm. Like all the Ulul Azm, like the, you can say, the supreme prophets. There are six of them. But we have like Prophet Nuh, Prophet Abraham, Prophet Musa, Prophet Jesus, Prophet Muhammad, and Prophet Adam, alayhi salam, the first prophet. So these prophets, six prophets, they're ulul azm basically. Or according to some, they don't count Prophet Adam alayhi salam, then we have five, plus Prophet Adam.
Five account is right too.
All these prophets are mentioned.
Yes.
Number one. Number two, the rest of the prophets, like Prophet Khizr and other prophets, why they're discussed in the Quran? Because this book is book of guidance. So Allah needs to give guidance. Therefore, these prophets who are mentioned, all of them, they have all those characters which the rest of the prophets from 124,000 prophets had. And it was, they have it collectively in themselves. And all the characters which all the prophets from Adam alayhi salam till Jesus had, all of them were in the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So we have these narrations and these things. So why the Jesus has been discussed in the Quran, it's because, number one, the followers of that religion, Christianity, are still in the world. They were at that time, at the time of the Prophet. Similarly, the story of the Musa alayhi salam of Bani Israel, it is also mentioned. The others as well.
That's right.
The polytheists, the stories of the polytheists are also mentioned, okay, like Mushrikeen, the idol, yes, worshippers, and all those. So basically, it's because we have many people who are still the followers of such prophets, yes, those prophets, number one. Number two, because these prophets, the characteristics of these prophets, this were in a way that they have become a role model, not for the people of their time, but for the people even after, yes, them. And because there's many discussions, especially in the Christianity, they believe that the Jesus is Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they believe.
Trinity.
Yeah, Trinity. Yes. They believe that Jesus is Son of God. On the other hand, in the Quran, we have seen, like in the history as well, that Mubahila has happened between the Muslims and the Christians.
Christians, that's right.
The main base was that there were some Christians who came from Najran to Medina to see what this prophet, new prophet, is saying. And when they came there, they said to the prophet that we believe in Jesus, Son of God. And the Prophet Muhammad said, I believe in Jesus, Prophet of God.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you're basically reducing the status of the Jesus,
yes,
from being son to the prophet, and you made him a servant of God. He's not the servant, he is the Son of God.
Okay.
And then Prophet argued, our Prophet said, what do you believe? What is your belief about the Adam alayhi salam? They said he was the servant of God. Then the Prophet said, Adam neither had the father nor mother. So he should enjoy that status of being the Son of God, whereas Jesus had the mother at least. So these were the arguments. So, yes, why Jesus is there? Because even in the Quran, we have the verse that Jesus has said, O Allah, I never said them that I'm your son. I'm your prophet, and you need to judge between us on the day of judgment.
Okay.
So the other reason, the second reason is because of the many followers of such religions. Therefore, it is necessary to talk about such prophets so that these people can come back to the right path.
That's right.
And the deviation which they had from the right religion,
yes,
they should basically refer back. And that's why the Quran is talking about the Jesus alayhi salam, the Virgin Mary, the role of Gabriel as, yes, an angel of, yes, revelation, and the other prophets as well.
That's all right. And really, there must be a lesson in all these life accounts of the previous prophets in the Holy Quran for not only the Muslims, but also, you know, the people of other generations who want to be familiar with their own, historical account of the life of the prophets and the great personalities like Lady Mary. And, you know, Lady Mary, you know, has really a special status. She's believed by the Muslims to be among the outstanding role models for the ladies all around the world. Isn't it, Sayyid Mirza?
Of course, yes. Role models and these great characters must have something to teach us. And if we can't find a lesson to learn from them, I don't think we can call them role models.
Yes.
And the Book of Islam is full of stories about these great characters. Jesus Christ himself and his mother, Lady Mary, both of these two names have been mentioned many times. Specifically, Lady Mary, I think her name has been mentioned over 34, 35 times. And it shows her great status in the Book of Islam. So these two characters, not only for Christians, but also for all humanity, have something to deliver. So in today's world, world, I think the followers of Islam and the followers of all religions must look into the private, social, and personal lifestyles of these two characters, because certainly we will find a lot of merits and advantages that we can pick up and use them in our own life. So I don't think it is right and correct to say that Muslims, for example, should not celebrate the birthday of Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So it doesn't show that Muslims are following the Christianity. It shows that they show their great respect to the birth of Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So today is the Jesus' birthday. So
yeah, December 25th,
Muslims,
that's right.
So all Muslims must respect.
Yes.
And if they celebrate, I don't think it's wrong.
Yes.
It's not because of the Christianity. It's because of the Holy Prophet, that his name has been directly mentioned many times in the Book of Islam.
That's
so there is a lesson for us.
Yes.
That we have to follow all these religions, all these prophets, and respect them as much as we can.
As we could see in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there are so many Christians living, and on these days, from December 25th to January 1st, they are celebrating the celebration in their own churches, in Tehran, in Yazd, in Shiraz, and in different places in Isfahan, all around the Islamic Republic of Iran, shows how much the also religious minorities like Christianity are respected in an Islamic land, the Shia Islamic land like Iran. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mursa and Sayyid Mohsen, for your presence in the program. And again, congratulations on the birthday anniversary of Isa ibn Maryam, Prophet Jesus Christ, and also congratulations to all our Christian brothers and sisters all around the world. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ and Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Isa ibn Maryam alayhim as-salam bashara atba'ahu bi nabiyyin ya'ti min ba'dihi ismuhu Ahmad. وأحمد هو محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم
عيسى نبي الله قال مبشرا بعدي سيأتي أحمد ومحمد
يا معشرا وصفوا المحمد بالقبيح قد كان أولى أن تقولوا كالمسيح من كان يتبع المسيح يقول ما قد قاله عيسى بأحمد من بديع
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The scale of the rebellion against the British government appears to be in part driven by the spiralling cost of living, with a separate analysis seen by the British media showing the crisis is having a devastating impact on Tory-held seats in the Red Wall. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Conservatives are facing electoral oblivion in the Red Wall as a shock poll revealed they will lose every single seat. Polling from Electoral Calculus, shared with The Independent, reveals all 42 Red Wall seats held by the Conservatives are set to return to Labour at the next general election. The scale of the rebellion against the government appears to be in part be driven by the spiralling cost of living crisis, with a separate analysis seen by The Independent showing the crisis is having a devastating impact on Tory-held seats in the Red Wall. The data compiled by analytics from Outre showing 15 Conservative-held Red Wall seats, which were won at the last election but have historically supported the Labour Party, are among the 50 constituencies with the highest number of financially distressed voters in the country, such as Great Grimsby, Blackpool South and Walsall North are among those with the highest portion of voters deemed financially vulnerable. In total, 15 of the top 50 seats in which voters are at risk of falling behind on their bills were won by the Conservatives in 2019. It follows research by investment firm Hargreaves Lansdown that shows the North East has been hit hard by the cost of living crisis. With the joint lowest level of savings in the country and just a third of households reporting they have enough cash left at the end of the month. The figures will set alarm bells ringing at number 10 Downing Street, with experts warning that voters facing financial distress will make their voices heard at the ballot box. Pollster and political analyst Robert Hayward pointed to a defining phrase from Bill Clinton's successful 1992 run to unseat George H.W. Bush as U.S. president. "It's the economy, stupid." He told The Independent that the economy is always the most important issue on polling day across all age groups, social groups and genders. Robert Hayward said it was especially important for the Conservatives, who always claimed they have historically been considered better managers of the economy than Labour. He warned the government has to restore that credibility. Robert Hayward added that Rishi Sunak's party may be doing so slowly, with inflation finally falling, but without further progress before an expected general election in October of 2024, the Conservatives will lose. The website Reddit has also covered the same story. YouGov polling shows almost two-thirds of British voters believe the economy to be one of the top three issues facing the country, putting it significantly ahead of healthcare and immigration. The risk of a Red Wall wipeout will also raise fears in Conservative headquarters, with Lord Hayward warning it will leave Rishi Sunak facing serious difficulty securing an overall majority. Addressing the collapse in support facing the Tories in the Red Wall, Lord Hayward said that while the party has achieved majorities without the voting bloc in the past, it delivered the size of that majority last time around. He added that the failure to win those seats next year would leave the Conservatives in serious difficulty trying to find an overall majority. Electoral Calculus chief executive Martin Baxter pointed to former Prime Minister Boris Johnson's acknowledgement that Red Wall voters had lent him their support in 2019. He stated, "And it looks like they're taking it back. The Conservative tide went up that beach in 2019 and it looks like the tide is going out again. The pollster is forecasting that the Tories will lose all 42 of their Red Wall seats. Martin Baxter said that while the economic figures underline the struggle in voters in those areas for the Conservatives, the prospect of the party holding on to power in the general election is already not likely. Nationally, electoral calculus predicts a landslide Labour victory, winning around 460 seats with the Conservatives reduced to just 90 seats. Many Red Wall seats were turned blue in 2019 as voters, repulsed by the Labour leader at the time, Jeremy Corbyn, backed Boris Johnson to get Brexit done and level up neglected towns and cities. But Outre's figures show that in many of those seats, voters are now feeling the pinch of the cost of living squeeze. In Great Grimsby, which Boris Johnson loyalist Iannucci won from Labour's Melanie On in 2019, more than a quarter of constituents are at risk of financial distress. Melanie On, who is Labour's candidate hoping to win back Great Grimsby next year, said the figures laid bare the reality of life under the Conservatives. She added, areas like ours that place trust in the Tories have been hit the hardest. Their economic mismanagement has caused incomes to nosedive, revealing a disregard for ordinary working people. In Blackpool South, held by suspended Tory MP Scott Benton, just under a quarter risk not being able to meet payments. And in Walsall North, represented by Eddie Hughes, 23.1% of voters are at risk of financial distress. Other Tory MPs believed to be vulnerable to losing their seats include Jonathan Gullis, Johnny Mercer and Jack Brereton. Exclusive polling by Omnisys found 62% of Britons believe the United Kingdom's economy is getting worse, with a mere 11% saying it's getting better. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak recently claimed there is light at the end of the tunnel, with average weekly pay going up by 7.8% in the 3 months to June. But voters still think the country is heading into trouble. This is despite the latest figures showing inflation slowing down to 6.8% in the year to July. With Labour Party at 36% in the polls and the Conservatives on 23%, the Prime Minister is under pressure to close the gap ahead of the next general election. The government is now facing calls to accelerate economic growth.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Other footage has been released.